Bienvenidos and welcome to episode 22 of the Jacobin Sports Show. I am Matthew Reina, joined as always by the human deja vu, Jonah Birch. Jonah, I want to know today which you find most existentially frightening. Is it Eric Adams being the front runner for New York City mayor? Is it Andrew Yang being a candidate for New York City mayor? Or is it reconciling yourself with the reality that all NBA second-teamer Julius Randle is vastly and now officially superior to pedestrian NBA employee Jason Tatum?
That is both a heavy question, and two out of the three parts of that are a lie. There is, obviously the third part, you're just trolling me, and it makes you question why reporters are able to vote on things that have a serious impact on players' financial situation and the rankings, the way at least NBA Twitter ranks players, because it's absurd Jason Tatum did not make an all-NBA team while some of these other people, I'm looking at you, Paul George, did.
Calling out names. Also, didn't just complain, but actually followed up with them. Substantiation. Good job, Professor Birch.
Check the numbers. But also, Andrew Yang is crashing in the polls. It's the Eric Adams campaign that we should all be terrified of. Because that is your next mayor of New York City, almost certainly.
I've written many times that I don't know if in New York City it is harder to find a quality point guard or a quality mayor, and they both seem to be this eternal struggle. Speaking of struggles, Jonah, in mid-July, my family is going to be attending a Yankee-Red Sox game at Fenway Park, and the one person who will not be attending the game is possibly the only person in the family who has always wanted to see Fenway Park, which is me, because my ass will be teaching an online course, so I just wanted to get that little complaint on the record in case my father is listening. There we go. So,
are they ready to go at it in the stands? Are they? Is your dad going to bring the brass knuckles? I guess Fenway is not. It's not what it used to be. Things are a little bit calmer.
They have already decided they're not wearing any clothes that identify them as fans of any non-Red Sox team. So, they should be safe. In today's episode, we will discuss the NBA playoffs. We will discuss NBA injuries, which are becoming possibly the dominant story of the NBA playoffs. We will also discuss our guests' work, as well as our guests' work working with workers to ensure that their working conditions are working. Our guest is the founder of Posting and Toasting, one of the great sites in human history. Our guest has also been deeply involved in the Beef History and Rewinder video series on SB Nation. Beef History is a really terrific video series where you get a deep dive into sports conflicts that you've heard of and maybe some that you were not aware of. Rewinder looks at really critical kind of small moments in sports history and kind of goes back and gives you backstory and build up into everything that went up to the significance of that moment. He is also one of the co-authors of We'll Always Have Linsanity, Strange Takes on the Strangest Season in Knicks History. He is a vocal member of the Vox Media Union, and he is today's honored guest. Welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show, Seth Rosenthal. How are you doing, Seth?
I am doing splendidly. Thank you for having me. That is the most thorough introduction I have ever received in my life.
Matthew is nothing if not thorough,
Thank you. Yeah, so let's start with, I guess the buzz is from last night, Kevin Durant's performance. But I'm especially interested today in a question relating to the reaction to it. This afternoon, I heard his manager, Rich Kleinman, on a radio interview say that he feels that last night's performance fully liberates Durant from ever having to answer questions about his greatness or whether he can come through in the big moment. I'm not really interested in like whether Kevin Durant proved it or not, because I feel like you probably have your feeling or you don't. But do you think that Kevin Durant honestly went into last night believing I still have to show people that I am like this clutch and this good? Or is this like a KD pulling a Michael Jordan thing where like, okay, I know there's people out there say something, so I'm going to pick something to respond to. But like, we all know this is nonsense, right? Like, he knows this is nonsense, right? Seth, does he know this is nonsense?
I have no concept of what Kevin Durant knows and does not know. All I noticed, well, let me be clear, first of all, I fell asleep at halftime. I deemed that acceptable. The Bucks were up by enough that I was like, well, if I wake up in the morning and the Nets came back and won, I'm going to feel like a dick. Woke up feeling like a dick this morning.
Respect the honesty.
As far as I can tell from watching highlights of the second half, what changed is that James Harden ceased trying to pretend to be a co-star. The Nets let Durant have the ball. The Bucks kind of freaked out defensively and didn't know what they wanted to do. And then the ball went in the basket. And narratively, that's about as far as I'll take it. I don't know what this means for anyone's greatness or what anyone was trying or not trying to prove, nor do I care. But it's pretty cool when the ball goes in the basket.
Yeah, it was very cool. He was hitting insane. He had one shot with the shot clock winding down, just saving like a lost possession in the last 2 minutes, and he's off balance. And it was really quite beautiful to see. Jonah, how did you feel? Go ahead, Jonah.
No. So I guess my question, and I appreciate the anti-take, you know, let's refuse to play the narratives. There's obviously a question about the Bucks and Coach Bud, and that is feels like it rears its head every playoffs. But my real question is, does this cement Jeff Green's legacy as one of the great random big game superstars, someone who will just come through when you least expect it with an amazing performance? What do you think this does for how we remember sometimes big game Jeff?
I'm absolutely willing to climb on board with that particular hot take. That Jeff Green really is, I'm trying to think of another good example and not immediately coming up with one. Maybe like Richard Jefferson, like in his later years, like these guys that when they're on, Al Harrington feels like this too, where it's like all of the necessary skills have always been present and you can't really give yourself a good reason why Jeff Green isn't a star. But yeah, every once in a while, every blue moon, Jeff Green, who I frankly didn't know played particularly well last night until you just said it.
A3s for Jeff Green last night.
Yeah, he can do that. He just has never been the type of person to do it consistently. And you know why? It's because he hasn't had the opportunity. If Jeff Green had the right coach, he would be a Hall of Famer. Shit. Let's just go there.
There's the hot take. That's what you're waiting for.
That is flaming hot.
I'm creating the bizarro Robert Horry with these occasional great moments. Jonah,
go ahead.
If you're going to keep going with that guy.
No, it's a genuine question for both of you. If Milwaukee loses the series, does Coach Bud get fired?
The way things are going, I'm not here to claim whether or not he should, although I think I would lean toward, he's kind of screwing things up, but the way things are going, it seems like he would. Like, this is a good, you know, just firing coaches is, as of roughly 4 hours ago, the hot thing to do. And yeah, the Bucks, especially given how royally they whiffed the last offseason, where they like tried to acquire Bogdan Bogdanovic, who it appears would be a pretty effective guy to have on that team right now, insofar as they are desperate for someone who can create their own shot.
Yep.
And yeah, front offices that have messed up perfecting what should be, you know, the very best contending roster tend to lean on the coach. And in this case, they probably have some justifiable cause to do that. So yeah, I imagine that would happen.
There's a lot of talk that there's not, you don't really have the one-on-one matchups anymore defensively. So it's not as big a deal to not put player X on player Y, but it was striking down the stretch of the fourth, especially Durant was exploding in that quarter in particular. And Milwaukee wasn't double teaming. The Nets weren't really running a ton of pick and roll. It was a lot of like letting Durant do his thing. And it was Chris Middleton all the time. It was PJ Tucker. And
yep.
I think it's hard for me to understand why at that point of your season you're not saying, okay, Giannis, like, and we learned this hopefully last year with Jimmy Butler, where like put your best player on their best player, if at least just to give them that look, Budenholzer definitely has some things maybe to answer for if things do not turn around. But all Milwaukee has to do is win a home game, and you're right back in a winner-take-all game. Atlanta-Philadelphia. Jonah, the Sixers were a couple minutes away from going up 3-1, and then a couple minutes later they were not. Do you think that Atlanta can take this all the way to the series win?
I mean, I feel like short answer is probably not. That was a fun game. That was a fun comeback. I guess I don't understand what's going on with Joel Embiid. I don't understand how hurt he is. He was a disaster in the second half of that game. What is he? He has is his meniscus?
They said a tear in the meniscus, and then Atlanta suggested, I think, that maybe it wasn't a tear and it was meant to throw them off the trail or something.
Look, I'm no doctor, but whenever you start even suggesting that you have a tear in something called your meniscus, it can't be good, right? And he did not look good. Mm-hmm. So, look, if he's hurt, I mean, really hurt, you know, who knows, right? I mean, who knows what's good. Now, if he's healthy enough to play the way he's played in stretches this series, there's no way Philadelphia loses this, right? But it really, a lot hinges, it feels like, on his health. Atlanta looked great in the second half of that game the other day.
Mm-hmm. Seth, as a Knicks fan, do you care if Atlanta, like, do you want revenge? Is the enemy of your enemy your friend, or do you not really care, like, what happens there?
I don't want revenge at all. I don't care. I love the Hawks. That was sort of, I came to understand that during the Knicks-Hawks series, that it was extremely frustrating to watch the Knicks, you know, shut themselves against the Hawks. But I like that team a lot. I like Trae Young. I like basically everyone but John Collins in terms of, like, watching them and, you know, liking the way they carry themselves on the floor. And their ability to stem momentum, their ability to generate a great bucket out of a really broken possession, whether it's Trae himself or just, like, they have such an incredible tendency to, in the 23rd second of a possession, find the corner and, you know, hit a three that just breaks your back. At the end of May, it was the worst thing that ever happened to me, but now I have been liberated from the shackles of caring about the playoffs, and it's really fun to watch the Hawks.
The Knicks fans are such warm-hearted, decent, ecumenical
people.
No,
we're not.
You know, I would just be like, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. But you guys are like, no, you know, I enjoy how they play. There's no hard feelings. Yeah, I would be a little ball of rage myself, but after, you know, what happened in that series. But I respect your willingness to forgive.
I think it only applies to the Hawks. it's a unique circumstance.
Yeah, you've had less experience with heartache as a Celtic fan. It conditions you as a person. It really does. Look at that, throwing his hands up, denying that reality.
No, no, I feel like it's been a lifetime of mostly heartache. Now, why John Collins? What's the history of your beef with John Collins, would you say? If you had to go back and, you know, describe this in a YouTube video.
It's nothing really about him personally. I just don't particularly like his game. I don't know. He's a type of player that, like, the big man who doesn't defend, can shoot, but not that well, can pass, but doesn't. You don't really need a good reason to not like a guy. I just don't.
He also has this Carlos Boozer quality where, like, when he gets a dunk, he seems disproportionately, like, proud of himself for having done it. And for me, that just, I can't stand that type of player. Like, I want you to have a sense of scale, even in the moment, that, like, if you block a guy 8 inches shorter, don't celebrate that much. Dunk when you're open, like, don't celebrate that. Like, be proud, but have a sense of scale.
I mean, as a rim runner, he's excellent. You know, he's got to be one of the...
Jonah, I thought you were going to qualify your own statement with as a rim runner. Like you're a roll man dunking type.
Yeah, Jonah mentioned earlier, right before we started recording, Jonah mentioned that he had played. He didn't say that he wasn't a rim runner, so it is possible we have stumbled.
You know,
so, Rich, how would you describe your game for the audience? Who are you out there on the court?
You know, I'm like a Pablo Prigioni type, I would say, you know.
Feeling good about yourself.
You're tearing up the courts of Riverdale, you know, with the 16-year-olds today, you know. Look, am I the most athletic on the court? No. But, you know, I have a lot of tenacity and some good passing skills, some good ball skills. And, you know, I like to think I'm a threat from the outside. So, you know, I'm a certain type of point guard out there.
The Jacobin Sports Desk is flooded with incoming calls from media seeking confirmation that Jonah Birch is, in fact, not the most athletic player out there. Stunning development on our show today. Another stunning development has been the just barrage of injuries to significant players in virtually every series. Malika Andrews tweeted earlier this afternoon that with Kawhi Leonard now will be out indefinitely with an ACL injury, Leonard is the eighth different all-star to miss a playoff game this year, which is the most in NBA history. Anthony Davis missed time. Harden played 46 minutes on a hamstring that had him out. Donovan Mitchell's missed time. Mike Conley will miss game five. Also, he's dealing with hamstring issues. Jaylen Brown obviously was out. Embiid has missed time. Kyrie. Chris Paul is out now on the COVID protocol. Atlanta lost DeAndre Hunter for the playoffs. In addition to Kawhi's injury, the Clippers have lost Serge Ibaka. A friend of mine, we were texting during the Knicks game last night, and it was very dramatic and exciting. When it was done, my friend's main takeaway was that he's just really disappointed by all the injuries that there have been in the playoffs. Do you feel like you've been, as a fan, in some way cheated by not having these big names around, obviously, in a season where there's been a lot of unique circumstances? I feel like when people are out, just other people step up, and you get to see stories that you wouldn't like maybe otherwise see that can be exciting, like Jeff Green last night, Blake Griffin had a really nice game. Do you feel like these playoffs have been lessened because Jamal Murray also being out, so many players have missed time, or do you feel like that adds kind of drama and uncertainty to a tournament that's already kind of a crapshoot in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, there's never been a playoff, even if this is record setting, every playoffs has that one team where it's like, yeah, well, if that guy was healthy, I don't feel cheated. That would be centering myself in the livelihood of others in a way that would be a little gross, but I'm sad. I would have liked to see. I mean, we didn't even mention the most important of all these people, who is Mitchell Robinson, who would have completely changed the framework of the Knicks-Hawks series. No, it sucks. It sucks when people are hurt. It, you know, I am sort of a little compulsive and a perfectionist about these things. So while I'm not going to go put an asterisk on whoever wins the championship, unless it's the Nets, in which case, you know, it's totally... It's frustrating. It just sucks as someone who likes all the little things to go the way they should. And you, the audience at home, I was miming puppeteering while I said that. It sucks. It's frustrating. And I like it better when people are hurt and injuries are the worst thing about being, you know, a pro sports fan. But yeah, it's hit the teams fairly evenly, with the kind of hilarious exception of the Bucks. I can understand why certain fan bases exiting this postseason will wonder what could have been, and why the fans of the team that does end up winning it all will get piled on by everyone else. That's how it goes.
Speaking of pile on, Seth, I want to discuss beef history.
Ooh, nice.
I want to know, how did beef history originate as a concept? How did it, where did this come from? How did you become involved in it? Did you just have too many beefs to keep within yourself and get them out in the world?
Beef history as a concept originated at a time when it was my job to make social video. So around the time that I started doing video stuff for SB Nation, the type of video we were doing was the type that every media outlet was doing in 2014, where it was like, we're making square videos with captions that go on Facebook They're all 53 seconds long, and you know, Facebook's algorithm is lying to us and telling us that a billion people are watching them. We're becoming rich and living forever. None of this will ever fall apart and prove to have been fake. And so it was my job to make that stuff. And there's a lot of incentive to make garbage when you're doing that, but that's makes it difficult to sleep at night. And so something that I was trying to do is to not merely say, here's what happened last night. It's a video. This will be completely obsolete in 24 hours. I tried to provide context for things. So back in those days, they were really short and they were square. But when, for instance, in a playoff series, Russell Westbrook and Patrick Beverley were going at it, instead of making a video that said Russell Westbrook and Patrick Beverley had a fight last night, it was, here is something that is, you know, as they say, evergreen. Here's some information about the last 6 years of this relationship that will help you understand what happened last night, but will also help you understand the next flare up a year from now. And in the years following, when Facebook proved to have been a complete, you know, Potemkin website and none of it was real and all the views were fake and it stopped making sense to program for Facebook, and I was allowed to make longer form, more interesting, better research videos with longer turnaround times, Beef History still made sense as a format of video that could depend on research and storytelling and explaining things, but also, you know, help people understand modern day stuff. But it, you know, it was less of that quick twitch turnaround stuff and more earnest, like making things people enjoy
now
work.
As one of the great contributions ever made to the internet, Beef History, and something that people thousands of years from now, you know, archaeologists will search the internet and they will, to understand our civilization, they will watch Beef History. I genuinely, one of my favorite things on all of YouTube, and I'm a big YouTube video guy. You know, I don't want to brag. I spend a lot of time there. Do you have a personal favorite that you have done? What is your favorite beef of all the, in all the history of beefs that you have chronicled?
I think my favorite episodes that I've made don't necessarily correspond to my favorite beeves. And that is the house plural is beeves, which is actually in the dictionary. Okay. There's one that we worked on at, actually at the very beginning of the pandemic, which was Vince Carter versus Toronto, which I really liked doing. And it feels good. Part of what's fun about Beef History is that those things tend to be pretty trivial and not the type of thing that someone's written an entire book about, with a few exceptions. And so with something like Vince Carter versus Toronto, obviously plenty of people were covering that at the time. It's been written about plenty. But I think that by sort of doing an, you know, my own idiot's version of an academic review of everything that was out there at the time and out there since, I think we made the comprehensive piece on that particular bit of trivia. And, you know, that was one where like things turned out pretty well in the long run, which feels good. A lot of these things, I get to the end and I'm like, and they still hate each other because, you know, these adults are actually babies. That was one. And I made a Serena Williams, Maria Sharapova one a few years ago that I really do feel proud of. Not because it's a particularly interesting beef, but because that is one of several where like, it's not just petty bullshit. There's some really interesting and sort of tough to wrangle forces in there involving the media and money and race and the way those things overlap with actual athletic prowess. And also the sort of career trajectory of those two people is very interesting, where Sharapova seemed like she might be taking over and then very much wasn't. And it was very interesting to go back and sort of follow that narrative as it was reported. But anyway, that was something that was really difficult to write. And, you know, the white dude trying to explain Serena Williams and her cultural cachet, I was not necessarily going to stick that landing. And I do think I did a good job of it and got really, really good, encouraging feedback. And that I wasn't going to get unless I did a good job. And so that one I still feel good about and like going back to.
If you haven't seen them, there's so many good ones. There's some of my favorites. There's Rasheed Wallace, First and Referees. There's Larry Bird versus Bill Laimbeer, Ray Allen versus Rajon Rondo, Shaq versus Dwight Howard, Shaq versus David Robinson. I know you did some video basically on Shaq versus like all centers ever.
and just to like some of those Shaq ones, because Shaq is who he is, that's an example of the other kind. And Bill Laimbeer, Larry Bird also, where like there just nothing important happens in most of those stories. They don't actually interact with real life problems in any meaningful, you know. Shaq versus Dwight Howard is just two men acting like infants. And I just don't worry about like, you know, telling their stories faithfully or like honoring the politics and culture involved. It's just two people acting like idiots. And that's fun too. That's a good beef. But there, you know, there are some that are like that. And there are some that like you really have to start thinking about how these people are viewed and, you know, real life shit.
I don't feel like if I'm in a room with Shaquille O'Neal and David Robinson, they're like, I need to run for cover based on like what it actually was about.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jonas.
I was going to say, I think you're wrong, and you'll be surprised to know, on the stakes of the Larry Bird, Bill Laimbeer beef. And I'll tell you why. Bill Laimbeer, the son of
religious
the,
for Jonah.
Of the bourgeoisie, his father was like a company president, I think, like a glass yes. company or something. Larry Bird, like a true child of the working class, you know, came from nothing in French Lick, Indiana. As we all know, big fan of Eugene Debs, really represents, you know, the working class struggle here against the bourgeoisie. So the stakes there couldn't be higher. It, you know,
I'll tell you what, Jonah. Yes, you are right. There is a meaningful class difference between those two people. Bill Laimbeer indeed is the son of, I think I grew up in a gated, I'm not going to use actual nouns that I can't prove, but grew up rich, and Larry Bird very much didn't. And what I will tell you to butter you up, Jonah, is that I read Larry Bird's autobiography that he wrote, I think in the early 90s, right around the time he retired, while researching that. And after getting to the end of it, I was like, wait, holy shit, do I love Larry Bird? Does this guy have cool politics? And I was, you know, I was Googling like Larry Bird socialist, Larry Bird voting record, like Larry, and Larry Bird seems like maybe kind of legit.
I think he might be on the left. I mean, that might be crazy and total projection. He talks a lot about class in this funny kind of like cultural way. Like when he would talk about why he wanted to win in the 80s, he'd say, well, you know, I had a responsibility to all the workers of the Celtics, you know, the people who worked at Boston Garden, you know, all the working class fans who had spent their money to come out, which could really go either way, like that way of framing things. But, you know, look, there is this famous picture and story of Larry Bird and Bill Walton at the Eugene Debs Museum in Indiana, looking particularly happy in a tomato face kind of way. You know, like, you got to respect the guy. I mean, at least I don't think, I think he's pretty thoughtful. Also reasonably thoughtful, I think, about issues of race and racism. I don't think he's conservative kind of white, whatever stereotypes people have of him.
Jonah, why do I get strong libertarian vibes from Kevin McHale?
I think Kevin McHale is just a straightforward Republican. Like,
yeah.
As far as I know, yeah.
Yeah. So, it's funny. I think Kevin McHale and I think Danny Ainge as well. I actually don't know about McHale. Danny Ainge, definitely. In fact, he has didn't his son run for some kind of office in Utah as a Republican? Utah. He's definitely, let's say he's not a progressive figure. And he did have a post, I mean, besides all the recent stuff about racism, which we talked about, he had a post in the fall where he was talking about how he opposed universal health care and kind of tried to ventriloquize the late Red Auerbach, Celtics president, you know, whatever, the coach and general manager, who, whatever else he was a liberal. I mean, famously Red, you know, he's just a liberal Jewish guy from Washington, D.C. Who the fuck knows what Red Auerbach would have thought about universal health care? But I responded. I said, Danny, you know, don't, you can't like misinterpret Red's politics to the, you know, to the internet. That's not fair. That's wrong to do. You shouldn't do that. He did not respond to me. So,
you know. Jonah, was it you? Was it you or someone suggested to me somewhat recently that Austin, I believe his name is Austin Ainge's campaign in Utah tanked because Gordon Hayward went from Utah to Boston and was mad at his dad?
Austin is the Celtics assistant GM. This is...
Sorry.
No, no, but it's another one. It's another age. You know, he's got a lot of kids. A lot of kids. Yeah. Right, you know. That is totally possible. Yeah, yeah. People were like, if you can't even keep, you know, if your father is going to steal away our star players.
Tanner.
Oh, God.
Tanner Ainge. Jesus. He ran for the house.
Matthew, would you ever name your kid Tanner? Is that something that you would think of doing? Or
that seems unlikely to occur. Anything that that is coming out, like any future beefs that people should be aware of or that you hope to get to someday, Seth, that you have not yet tackled?
On the very grand scale, there are some, you know, really big historic things that we have not done and I'm kind of holding on to. Like, for instance, Shaq and Kobe is something that I don't want to do a 15-minute video about Shaq and Kobe. That's a whole piece. And we had actually talked about doing it last summer, but after Kobe died, I unless the person's a true piece of shit, I never want to make a video where I think if this person were to see it, it would make them feel terrible.
Yeah.
And I think that releasing a Shaq Kobe beef history months after Kobe Bryant's death might have made Shaq feel pretty terrible. In the future, maybe. And I know there's a lot of work being done about Kobe and stuff now. So maybe, you know, I've missed my opportunity. But in the near future, I have written and there is currently in production a Tony La Russa versus Dusty Baker episode.
Oh, that I'm excited that's a about. Good one.
That's a fun one. My colleague Clara Morris, who is terrific, just wrote and released a Reggie Jackson versus Russell Westbrook one, which is in that sweet spot where it's like recent enough that you're like, oh, right, of course those guys hated each other. But just distant enough that I forgot that Reggie Jackson told reporters he was too hurt to play and then pulled off a windmill dunk right in front of them during practice. Like, there's all sorts of incredible details that are from like 7 years ago. But yeah, we're still chugging along making our beefs.
Let me ask you this question. Is so the historic beefs, as I like that, I'm taking that. So like, is it just too far in the past? Like, are we like a Rudy Tomjanovich versus Kermit Washington or something? Or, you know, are those too old? A Wilt versus Russell, that kind of thing?
You've touched on two different important things that occasionally make it difficult to do an episode. One is when there's no beef. Kermit Washington, you know, punched Rudy Tomjanovich really hard one time. But as far as I can tell, that was a fight. That was one extremely life-changing, history-changing incident. But as far as I can tell, those two people did not hate each other. It was a basketball fight that went too far. And there, you know, sometimes when people request that, and correct me if I'm wrong, if they had a longstanding thing that I don't know about, then I missed it. So there are some things we haven't done that would otherwise seem obvious, because I'm not really interested in just telling the story of a fight, one brawl, you know, Doc Rivers and who's it, Kevin Johnson had that huge throw. Like, as far as I can tell, that was just, it's sports, it's the heat of the moment, they got in a fight and that was it. Sometimes that's not the case with a fight. And then the other thing you touched on is that I am making video and I am beholden to fair using copyrighted material. And so I use licensed photos, I use licensed scanned images of newspapers. And other than that, I'm trying to fair use whatever is on YouTube. And, you know, I am, because of budget constraints and time constraints, not digging through archival footage unless it's really a big project or I really need one specific thing.
Sure.
And so, and then I think there's the additional variable of like audience interest. And I like to think that, you know, if we did Wilt and Bill Russell, like I could get people into that. And, but it would be a greater task to get the necessary coverage. You know, if I'm going to talk for 15 minutes, I need to be able to show you something that whole time.
Yeah.
And that gets more difficult the farther back you go in history. So sometimes it's merely a practical thing that's stopping us short of that. But that, you know, there are other variables involved there, but that doesn't mean that I couldn't or wouldn't do that. It just means like, I need to have time and I need to have stumbled across something that would make that worthwhile.
I had one other, I don't think you've done a Chris Paul versus the Clippers beef history. Have you? That has not happened.
No, we've done some Chris Paul ones, but not, you know, yeah. I mean, we've only in the last year started to do like player versus entire franchise.
Right.
And it's gone better than I would have expected. I used to be sort of orthodox about beef. You know, I came up with this idea. And so I had all these like rules I came up with about what is and isn't beef. And then I think we did the Vince Carter versus Toronto one. It was like, oh no, this is totally doable and fun and interesting and like doesn't start to stray into being about something else. And so yeah, Chris Paul versus the Clippers, there's definitely enough meat on the bone there. We've done a bunch of Chris Paul ones, but never, mm-hmm. you know, the Blake, Doc, Austin Rivers, all of that whole team.
That seems like a juicy one. I guess, and yeah. I don't want to hijack this discussion. It did seem up until yesterday as if we were headed potentially. I mean, I don't want to count the Jazz out. At the beginning of the season, by the way, Matthew, I don't know if you remember, we had a conversation. Are the Jazz a real contender? You said no. I said yes. I feel like I've been vindicated there, you know, about my, you know.
Do you?
Yeah. Yeah, I think they are a real contender, for sure. At least a contender. I mean, I don't know. If Donovan Mitchell is healthy, they could totally win this series. If Donovan Mitchell and Mike Conley are healthy, they could absolutely give Phoenix a run for their money in the Western Conference Finals. Who knows what happens then? There is 100% a scenario where the Jazz are your 2020-2021 NBA champions. Do you not?
You just agree? gave me two ifs, two coulds, and a who knows.
Look, I know you.
It's the playoffs, baby.
Yeah, that's how it is. Like this year in particular. Yeah, don't tell me you have any idea. Like you're not sure who's going to win right now. I'm not sure.
I have no idea. Sure. I have no idea.
I am sure. I'm not going to say, but I am 100% certain.
Well, you know, all right. You know, that's why they pay you the big bucks. But the rest of us. Now, do we, now that it's come out, first of all, that Kawhi is hurt. Did anyone know that he had a serious knee injury that could?
There was that moment. There was a bit of a non-contact fright during that game, but it didn't look like he messed up his ACL.
I mean, this could be really serious. Who knows? You know, he also is such a cipher. Who can tell? He's in the post-game press conference. Seems like he's fine. But even more confusingly, Chris Paul and his mysterious COVID exposure. Is he vaccinated? Is he not vaccinated? Who really knows? Is this the curse of the anti-vaxxer, you know, on the NBA playoffs? If this...
Man,
I
really hope that the head of the players union is vaccinated. That would be a pretty bad. And I did. I saw some clip of Jalen Rose speaking on television in which he said, as if it was obvious that Chris Paul was vaccinated. But who knows what Jalen Rose knows? I hope he's vaccinated. I hope everyone's vaccinated. But I particularly hope Chris Paul, given the position he's in, is vaccinated.
Very true.
Totally. Very true. I know none of us are doctors, but maybe I'm just a misunderstanding. But if he's vaccinated, I mean, I guess you could still theoretically get sick with COVID. In what scenario would he be vaccinated, but then be his COVID exposure would force him to go into protocols? I guess if he was showing symptoms.
I don't know whether, is he showing symptoms?
I'm just
I think it's just that the NBA puts you into maybe a diet protocol if you've been exposed, whether or not you're vaccinated.
But so then why wasn't LeBron put into the protocol for his pre-playoff exposure? What is going on?
I mean, what seems entirely possible is that because Chris Paul's team has already dealt with its playoff round, and because there are some days between now, whatever exposure happened, and the date that he has to play basketball again, the NBA will be like, exactly that amount of time is how long you have to be in COVID protocol.
Right.
Where you're out as soon as game one happens, but we, you know.
Yeah, don't do it again.
We did our job.
Let me ask you this, and I know I asked this 2 weeks ago, Matthew, and maybe I ask it every show. Now that that impressive sweep of an admittedly shorthanded Nuggets team happened, if Chris Paul takes the Suns to the finals and, you know, God, you know, potentially wins, has the narrative changed on him forever? And I know we're not doing hot takes here. Is he going to get the credit that he deserves as one of the great players of the last couple of decades if that happens this season?
I imagine for some people he will. I imagine in particular for people who don't probably get to watch him a ton and mostly follow him through like the prism of other people's takes, like that might do it. I feel like if you've watched Chris Paul a lot, I don't think that he's not my favorite player to have watched over his career. As great as he is, he's just not like exactly my cup of tea. But anyone who watches him, I don't think you can really doubt how incredible he's been. Years where his team didn't lose because of him. His team in Houston was the only one during the Golden State healthy Durant years that really like had that team on the ropes. And like, he's not a lesser player because he got injured at the end of game five. Like, that doesn't suddenly make him not as good as someone whose hamstring didn't go out or whatever it was at the end of that game. So I think it will, like, I do think there's that very general nationalized conversation that some fans have. And I think that will change. But if you came into 2020-21 being like, I'm not really sure Chris Paul is that good, then I don't know how much he can do, you know, to give you that idea.
Seth, are you just staying far away from these narrative discussions? Who gives a fuck?
That is just not how I ingest basketball.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But also, I do look at Twitter 25 hours a day, and I see what people say about these people. And I think that we have pretty solid examples of how Chris Paul is going to be talked about. Like, if he doesn't go on to win a championship basically in the next year or two, you know, we have Steve Nash, we have John Stockton, a couple of the greatest point guards of all time who have a lot in common with Chris Paul. Didn't win a championship, but you know, got pretty close. And I don't know. I don't know how to qualify how people talk about them versus Magic or Isaiah Thomas, but you know, you certainly still hear their names. For some reason, it's more of a meme with Chris Paul. I guess because of his era, it's more of a meme with Chris Paul than some others. But
sure.
Yeah, I'm sort of with you, Matthew, in that he's never been one of my favorite players, and there's plenty of good reasons to dislike the guy, but like, he's incredible. He is unbelievable and has had some sensational playoff moments and has been the only reason that entire franchises even came close to contending, let alone winning or coming close to winning some series, going all the way back to like the Hornets. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't particularly care, but also I think there's precedent, and I think it would be cool if he wins a championship because it would shut some people up.
Now, here's a hot take question for you. If that fight between Jokic and the Suns had escalated, who would have won? The Suns or the Jokic brothers, the Serbian brothers sitting in the stands screaming at Devin Booker? In Serbo-Croatian. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Jonah, today I saw a video of Nikola Jokic, who has returned to Serbia, and he was sort of placidly bopping along in a chariot pulled by a horse. That's the man who wins the fight.
Fair enough.
Very fair. I want to go from sports to a little bit of sports media here on a few of Seth's experiences specifically. Seth is a member of the union, he's at Vox Media, and just curious where you feel like things stand. There's been, even before the pandemic, sports media had been having you know, some issues at major sites, ESPN, Sports Illustrated, The Athletic. Where do you feel like, as a union, you stand right now, like at Vox? Do you feel good about where you are? Are there like major issues, you know, on your mind right now that you think you're going to be dealing with soon?
Yeah. I mean, I feel very thankful that we have a union. I have never felt more thankful than having gone through a pandemic and its associated furloughs and layoffs to have some bargaining power when that stuff happened. Sports media seems a little further behind the rest of digital media when it comes to unionizing, but it's really exciting to see Sports Illustrated headed in that direction. And they're, you know, they're up against it. They got some messed up ownership situations going on. And yeah, anyway, coming back to my own thing, like Vox Media is, earnestly, I think, a with or without a union, a healthier company with healthier leadership than, say, Sports Illustrated. We have not yet been overrun by a hedge fund or some gigantic conglomerate. I know our CEO, he's a CEO, but we were able to work with him. And I feel good about that. I think that we are almost exactly 2 years into a 3-year collective bargaining agreement. And what I see being particularly important to our unit and to me is, one, we are one of, I think, many digital media companies that are getting way more dispersed entering 2021, in that we are one of those companies that previously had been like, you know, we're a media company, we should have really fancy real estate in downtown Manhattan and have desktop computers and snacks and Wi-Fi for 500 people. And they are also one of those companies that after the last year have said, oh shit, everyone can make us just as much money from their own, you know, homes. Why are we paying for all this real estate? And so we have been told, yeah, you don't have to live in the city anymore. You know, you can go live somewhere else. And we've opened up jobs that are remote in a way that we weren't before. And that's I think a good thing. I think that's great if people could work for a, you know, a fancy New York media company and not have to live in New York City. That makes things more equitable. It also means that for the people who work here, you know, we need to make sure that we have the equipment, the support, the literal physical, I need back support in a way that I am not getting at home and I was getting at the office. My spine, I'm talking to you from my bed right now. My spine is suffering from not having my office there. But yeah, so there are different material concerns that I think all workers who have shifted from mostly in the office to mostly remote will have. And then for me, you know, I am a member of the union. I was on our organizing committee, our bargaining committee. I'm on our diversity and equity committee. And we have, you know, especially compared to other contracts, I think pretty strong, it's compromised as it always is, but pretty strong language in our contracts pushing for the company to be more diverse and more equitable. But that language is focused, you know, having done research on the Rooney Rule and, you know, what other digital media companies have done looking at other contracts, that language is mostly focused on recruiting and hiring. And we like I said, have pretty good language ensuring that the company is not dragging its feet, is not shirking its duties, and ensuring that every time we hire someone, we are not falling on, you know, the leadership is not falling on the lazy tactics of just like, well, who do I know? Which cousins of mine could work here? What well-connected, you know, college-educated, New York-based white person has the built-in resume for this job? We have specific numbers in place that are ensuring that there are entire groups of people that are terribly underrepresented at this company, and they are required to make sure that they are giving people with less traditional roots in media from a variety of backgrounds a shot. There is that. I'm glad that's there. But what we've realized is that at a company like ours, attrition is really important. And our contract does not address, okay, cool, you hired some Black people. Okay, cool, you hired some, you know, gay and trans people to work at your company. The percentage went up. That's the front door. There's also the back door. If the company is a shitty place for those people to work and people find that they are not being creatively satisfied, that they do not have an upward career trajectory, that they are not getting the opportunities or the mentorship that they should be getting, or even that other people are getting, that they have bad bosses, then they are going to leave. And all of that, all of the entry point work was for naught if you are not taking care of people. And it is a sign of an unhealthy workplace if there is attrition, especially from groups of people that are underrepresented in journalism, but particularly underrepresented at the company. So that's why I guess it is a diversity and equity committee. And that is why what is the diversity clause in our contract, I think, also needs some ways to make sure that people are playing on a level playing field when they're here and are getting the same opportunities when they're here and are not getting treated like shit when they're here.
You started at SB Nation, was it around 07?
Yeah, I mean, I SB Nation meant something very different when I started, but right. Yes, when I was in high school in 2007, I founded SB Nation's Knicks blog, Posting and Toasting. And then in the intervening years, like while I was in college, SB Nation became an actual website with a full-time staff, and then Vox Media sprouted out of that. And I started a full-time job for SB Nation in 2013. But yeah, I predate SB Nation as we know it.
Much like the New York Knicks predate the NBA at their initial season of the NBA. So the reason I'm asking about that is you've seen the company and you know, different sides of the profession, like over a number of years in a number of different places. You started the site, I think, on your own. You've done, you know, writing work, you've done video work, you're a member of the union now. I think it's the so-called mothership is like actual or .com or whatever. I saw in an interview with you that you were talking about one of the challenges, at least a few years ago. It's not just unique to SB Nation, it happens to other companies too, is that there are platform companies like SB Nation, the team sites in particular, that there's so many of them, and there's opportunity, either if you start as a commenter or if you pitch yourself as a writer, you can gain a platform, you can gain a stage and a canvas to be seen. And a lot of people have used that to get their work out there and to earn, you know, more of a foothold in the industry, if not a place outright. But you talked about how one of the inequalities, and I thought of it just as you mentioned, I mean, some things have gotten better. Most people who are able to take advantage of those opportunities are people who have the privilege of not having necessarily to work full time to support themselves, because a lot of those positions across the industry are unpaid or low paid. I'm curious, you came in doing your own thing, you're part of the union, you've been here for years. If you were breaking in today, do you think you would feel more optimistic than you did when you first actually started to get into the industry? Like, do you have a vibe about, between all the improvements and all the negatives, I think ultimately this, or is it just, you know, shit changes and there it is?
Yeah. More or less optimistic is a really difficult calculus, because on one hand, you know, in 2007, when I was entering college and thinking, oh, maybe this is what I'm going to do, there was much less professional blogging, you know, much less money to be made in terms of covering sports without any access. And then while I was in college, jobs started to become available to people doing that kind of thing. And indeed, access followed, you know, where people who were bloggers ended up being reporters. But also you can make money just as a blogger now. That transition from Wild West to industry, I think, is a fortunate time to be just starting, to be 18 years old or 20 years old or whatever. And so in that regard, like, I think it's much harder right now to start your Knicks blog, you know, build yourself a platform and then just go get a job than it was at the time I did that. And I got really fortunate. And in ways you mentioned also, when I was in college, I didn't have to work to pay my tuition. I because of my family and because of the college I was at, I didn't have to work full time while I was in college. And in fact, I went and lived with my parents for a year after college, which is to say that I, like a lot of people, was working long hours really, really hard to make posting and toasting work. And I was doing it for basically no money. And I had the wherewithal elsewhere in my life to do that. And I turned all of that work into the job I have now. And other people who are more talented than I am didn't have the same opportunity because they couldn't stay up till 2 a.m. recapping the Knicks getting the shit kicked out of them by the Clippers, you know, and writing 1500 words about that. And I could, and that's not fair. And that sucks. And it's insofar as that kind of work, that kind of, you know, blogging for fun is an entry point into the industry. It's limiting the pool of people that take that first step, and it's curtailing the sort of, you know, insofar as places are hiring, it's curtailing the opportunities.
Can I ask you guys about posting and toasting, which I feel like has this semi-legendary reputation among, particularly among Knicks fans, but it seems like it reached this point where it kind of became this funny, I don't know if community is, like, community is always a subtly loaded word, but, like, it took on a life of its own, I guess I would say. How much of that was the reporting you were doing? How much of that was the contributions of people who were participating in the discussion boards? And how did that happen, I guess, would be
well, one question. Well, yeah. Matthew, I'm curious what you think about that, because you were someone who went from commenting to writing really good fan posts to me emailing you being like, I need help, and you're a really good writer. So you've kind of experienced it from outside and inside.
Yeah, I felt, so my first exposure to it, I think I used to get links through Extra Mustard on Sports Illustrated, and I'm not too proud to admit that, like, it literally, I think Seth really likes, like, marine life, and there were these posts that would be there every week that would usually open with some long, just not long, but like a good discussion of something having to do with some marine life, and then all these links that had something to do with the Knicks. And it took me an embarrassingly long time to figure out that this was coming from a place that talked about the Knicks. I literally thought Seth was a fish dude who for some reason happened to talk a little bit about the Knicks at the end. And when my brain finally put together, like, oh, holy shit, posting and toasting, Clive says that might be a Knicks site. Then suddenly, like, ah. So I would say that I felt, in my experience with it, that Seth had a, and you know, you can hear it, you know, in his taste and his perspectives as a fan. I enjoyed it because it was not, I felt the site itself had made a point of promoting this ethos of, like, we have fun following this team. We do it for many different reasons. And we're not here for, you know, we're not here as some kind of like homogeneous fan base. Like, part of the fun of this is that, you know, some people are only here to see a title, and some people are here just because every night it brings them and other people together. And some people are here because they moved away from New York City, and this is one of the ways that they identify, like, with their roots. And I found that there was an ethos of that at the site that I think the commenters over time, especially, you know, had a much stronger sense of, like, okay, this is what we're about and this is what we're not. And that fluctuates, and sometimes it, you know, runs amok and gets reined back in. But I felt like it started that way. I felt like there was an energy and an approach and a humanity to the site's perspective on being a fan that drew me in there. And then you could find your place among commenters. Like, okay, I really click with these couple of people. When I see these three going at it, I'll stay away. For me, that's how I felt.
I take a great deal of pride in exactly one thing that I did at Posting and Toasting, and it is community moderation. I think that Yeah, I mean, I think, Jonah, you touched on something true, which is that community is a little bit of a bullshit word on the internet. And if someone's saying that, you might want to start doubting everything else they say. And I speak for my own company there that it's sometimes like, what are we really talking about? But posting and toasting, I was there when posting and toasting had two people commenting, and I could see on SiteMeter where they were in the world. And it was so exciting to talk to those two people. And by the time, you know, Linsanity rolled along, there were thousands of people with accounts commenting. And as, again, I wasn't getting told or paid to do this, but I was obsessive over the comment section, and I read every single comment. And if someone was popping off or if two people were fighting, I used the pretty solid Vox Media, they call it course, the commenting tools. I would use the tools available to me to talk to people privately. And, you know, I banned people but also I would get in these long email discussions with people, which drove me insane. I don't know why I dealt with this. It was genuinely like I would ruin whole weeks going back and forth with someone who just like was a troll. Like I shouldn't have given them the time of day, but I worked really, really hard to be as welcoming as possible, but also, and to sort of honor like free speech and let people express themselves and let people be assholes, but also tell people that they were being assholes and give them a chance. And I had my thumb on the scale for the entire creation of that community. And
can you give us an example? Like, so would it be like someone would use some terrible homophobic slur and you'd be like, listen, here's why you shouldn't do that. And they'd be like, fuck you. And you'd be like, no, let's have this conversation. No,
that's easy. If someone's using a homophobic slur, I banned them. I didn't have to think twice about it. But there, you know, I can think of specific people in specific conversations where, you know, sometimes often at Posting and Toasting, the conversation in the comment section, because it was the summer or because it was somehow relevant to the topic, would drift into politics. And I was okay with that. That's fine. But there would be, you know, whole 1,000 comment threads about Israel. And I wouldn't cut it short, but I would sometimes pop in and take someone aside using the warning mechanism that I had or email or whatever to be like, hey, just a reminder, you're in the comments of a Knicks blog, you're not having fun. That was really often what I was telling people. Sure. Is either you don't look like you're having fun in the comments of a Knicks blog, or you are making it harder for other people to have fun in the comments of a Knicks blog. Why are any of us here except for diversion? You seem genuinely upset. This is a problem for everyone. And so, yeah, if someone was being homophobic, if someone was being racist, or if someone was just clearly only trying to get a rise out of people, I had no problem getting rid of them. But if someone was just kind of getting like too in their feeling, too heated, it was sort of just taking them aside to be like, hold on, just remember where you are for a second. Sure. Remember how much everything else sucks. And like, I'm not saying you can't talk about Palestine here. If you need a safe place to talk about Palestine, by all means. But like, let's not freak out.
Yeah. Or this isn't the place, at least, right? You know. Yeah.
But yeah, I think the most frustrated I ever got was with the people where like, I really wanted to just ban them. I really think they were, and I'm sure, Matthew, that you can name specific commenters. I know I can. That like, I gave way too long a leash. Because they stopped just short of saying outright hate speech, but they were just assholes. And, you know, I was always inclined to think of Posting and Toasting and its comments like a bar, like a restaurant, where if someone were in there being an asshole, it would be on the bartender, on the shopkeep to say, you need to just go. You're making it worse for all the other customers. And I think I sometimes had too long a leash with that stuff.
Yeah, I did too when I started as a moderator. I think, again, because I saw the example that you set there, and you do feel like, you know, very slippery about it. I don't want to, it was hard for me, especially initially, to ever think about like even deleting a comment, much less like banning a person. But doing it more, I would say, like, you begin to recognize a type of commenter who, and it's not at all a large number, but there are commenters, and some of them will transparently come back with a new account name like 2 minutes later. But they know how to go right to the limit, because then they can argue with you about like, wait a minute, like, why are you? And that I eventually learned, like, I'm not, like, when I ban someone, I tell them exactly why, like, here's what happened. And I always tell them, like, you can email me, like, if you'd like to talk about this, like, further. No one has taken me up on it yet. So there is
Some
that.
people are there, some people are there just to feel something, just to get any sort of attention. And it's like, it's a habit you see in everything from preschoolers to, like, internet right-wing trolls, where it's just like, you just acknowledged, and this is, you are clearly not well, you're not happy, and this is how you're acting out, and it's my problem now. But like, at a certain point, I can't be patient about this anymore.
Like, whatever led you to this moment to be doing this, I want to backtrack. Something along the way didn't go where it needs to
Now,
go.
let me ask you this. Is it true that you're a big submarine animal life guy? Is the origin story of toasting and posting the same as the origin story for My Octopus Teacher? I guess it's what I'm really asking.
My Octopus Teacher, that was me and Chris Duhon at a different time. It's a pretty straight. I really like wildlife. I really like animals. I, in the same way that I am obsessed with little NBA bits of trivia, I have, since I was a child, been very into the animal kingdom. And so, yes, when it's still kind of a thing, but it was very much a thing in 2007 to do lynx posts. An easy way to get traffic is, and frankly, a good service, I think, for fans of a basketball team is to be like, here's all the cool stuff I read today. And when I was coming up with my term for those posts, everyone was like, the Daily Lynx, or like the Washington Bullets for today. And like, it had been played out. And so I just named all those posts. I would pick one animal. I did mammals for a while. I did fish for a while. Maybe I did birds at some point. I did reptiles for a while. I would go pick an animal. I would learn a little bit about them. And the first link out of, there would be nine links that were like, here's what's up with Danilo Gallinari's injury or whatever. But the first one would be telling you about, skinks. And that's how I distinguished myself.
I'm not even going to go there.
Seth, is there anything that you miss or do not miss about your time at Posting and Toasting? Especially this year, when the team had, one of its, it was nice to, I, it was the first year I wrote on the site when the team was actually good, which was weird. It was actually at times harder for me to do recaps because I was so used to years of like seemingly meaningless loss and like trying to find something to coalesce around. And this year, like, the games mattered. It was a very different feel. I wonder if you missed that from what it must have been like in 2013, or if there are other kinds of things that you recall with fondness or don't.
I'm going to be honest, there are more things that I'm glad I don't have to do anymore than there are things that I miss. I think I miss having sort of a, it's not private, but I guess a safe and sort of separate place to just talk about the Knicks. For me, it's either like various group texts with people who don't really care as much as I do, or, I mean, honestly, Bhaskar and Ramike, from Jacobin, I've just started texting about the Knicks because they're sickos. I miss that. I miss that. Now I feel like if I have something I just feel like getting off my chest about the Knicks, I like do it on Twitter, which is just not healthy and like is not going to get me the kind of feedback I want or like start anything resembling a interesting conversation. It's just dumb. What I don't miss is a whole lot of stuff. I don't miss feeling like Knicks games are work. And that goes for wins and losses. I took detailed notes about every Knicks game for 10 years, and I I really care. The Knicks make me feel feelings, and I've gotten better about that. But like, I sometimes come out of a Knicks game feeling like I just, you know, blew through a rail of cocaine, and I come through some Knicks games feeling really upset. And writing, when one is in that position, can probably lead to some good work, but also isn't fun. It's late at night. It's a Tuesday. I have an actual job to do, and the Knicks just lost, and I feel shitty about it, and I don't want to think about it anymore. And so being able to just watch games and zone out, and, you know, if it's the fourth quarter and a 3-point deficit turned into 19, I'm going to turn it off, is something that took a little bit of getting used to and was an immense relief when I first got to feel it. And now I could never go back. I don't miss I miss the community. I miss the people, but like, I still read the comments, and I don't miss having to moderate those comments. So I running, posting, and toasting, starting it and running it was immensely gratifying. It got me where I am. I met a lot of, you know, really cool people, and I loved it. It was for a, younger me, and it was for a different me, and I could never go back to it.
Between posting and toasting and the Strickland, I probably covered like about 60 of the 72 games this year. And I made sure to like take some off. And the nights that I just got to sit as a fan for the first time in a while and just watch the game, like, literally felt tangibly lighter, like you're saying. Like, it literally felt like I was 10 pounds lighter just sitting there watching the game.
Yeah. And especially, you know, when it's a team like the Knicks and they're going to hurt your feelings pretty often, there's something to be said for not having to immediately turn that into content and traffic. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, and to be clear, like, the latter era of my posting and toasting run, when you were around and Joe was around and Joe worked really hard, to be able to split up the labor a little bit, you know, even though none of us were getting fairly compensated for that labor, but at least we were sharing the wealth and, you know, supporting one another. Mm-hmm. That was good. I'm mostly referring to the years where it was me. It was just me. You know, and then, and before you guys, we had John Casimiro, who was awesome. We had Charlie Osborne, who was awesome. But there were some years where it was like, if I don't deal with this, whether it's a game that's happening or, you know, they're signing Steve Novak. I can specifically remember I was at my wife's girlfriend at the time's house, like meeting her parents for probably the second time, eating dinner, and the Knicks signed Steve Novak. And I was like, I gotta go poke my laptop for an hour. I just have so, like, my entire time in college and some years thereafter was spent being constantly on call for anything that might happen with the Knicks. And I can give you very specific examples of times when either I had to put the Knicks aside because real life shit was happening, or I had to put real life shit aside because Knicks were happening and I was so obsessive about it. And I, you know, it would never be like that ever again. And I got help, and it didn't have to be that way anymore, but that sucked.
Uh-huh. I mean, can I just say, this has always seemed like the great contradiction of NBA reporting in general to me. Like, you get into it because you love basketball, and often that means you love a team, but then it becomes, you know, your job. And first of all, you have to take all your emotions out of it, which seems impossible to me. But second of all, it's like classic alienation, you know, commodity fetishism. Like, you are subject to the dictates of production of your, right, which seems really, how could that not make you resentful and feel very detached?
I couldn't be Woj, tell you that much. But I mean, mm-hmm. I am extremely fortunate to have a job where I write about sports, but I am not covering sports. I am not responsible for processing the news or the scores or the strategy as it happens. And so I'm allowed, you know, I do research about history, and I want to contextualize things that are happening, but You know, especially as someone, as we've touched upon, who does not really come honestly to takes, I feel really free getting to watch a game or see news as it happens and not think, okay, what do I do with this? I can just experience it as a fan, and I still have a job in sports. That's mm-hmm. rare.
Early on when I met Seth, he told me a couple of things he was working on, and he showed me like a scan, a picture of his desktop, and it had like 8,000 like things open on it. And I remember being, or just 8,000, his desktop was just literally icon. And I remember thinking like, you know, my God, like what madness, like how lucky that that's not me. And now I always have like 70 tabs open and like 24 screenshots on my desktop all the time. If you're listening to this, this is basically a cry for help. Just letting you know. So we want to thank our guest, Seth Rosenthal, for being with us in today's episode. Seth has a video coming out. Look for it. It's about the Cleveland Cavaliers, and it's about the history of the franchise from its origin until they won their first title in 2016 with LeBron James. And it gets into there's a really deep dive into the very shocking 1976 Cavs, who made a spirited run to the Eastern Conference Finals, where they lost a pretty tight series to Dave Cowens and the Celtics. It goes through, it was an interesting team, a team whose three best players were all named Jim. They had Campy Russell, they had a player named Foots Walker. And then the series gets into, or the episode gets more into the Cavaliers of the 80s, who became infamous for their team owner just trading away every single draft pick in creation and forcing the NBA to step in and create a rule that is still in place today that doesn't allow teams to make those kinds of deals.
The Stepien rule.
Yep. It touches on the great Cavalier teams of the late 80s and early 90s, the ones that a lot of people thought were going to be the successor to Detroit and Boston in the East. Unfortunately for them, Michael Jordan existed, so that did not happen. It looks really, really great. If you've seen any of Seth's work with these video series before, either Beef History or Rewinder, you know how great and in-depth they can be, so check that out. You can follow Seth on Twitter at Seth_Rosenthal. Our producer is the ruggedly handsome Connor Gillies. Please remember, you can follow the Jackman Sports Show on Twitter at Jackman Sports, or email us with thoughts, questions, suggestions, or recipes to jackamansports@gmail.com. That is all for this week's episode. Thanks for being with us, and we will see you next time. Thank you.